Beth, what you had a suggestion for an icebreaker for this week's episode. Well, you asked me this question before, but if you want to ask it to the floor.
Yeah, so it's something I think very deeply about, especially over the past 4 weeks. And my question for the floor is that if being hit by a vehicle didn't cause you harm or death, what would you want to be hit by?
Ooh, I would want to be hit by one of those, like, really low to the ground, like souped up cars, because I reckon, like, getting hit by one of those is going to, like, really, like, shoot me off.
That's like, what I said.
Really?
Yeah. I've got Oh my God,
we're so married.
Yeah, I would say a bullet train. Ooh, going at the faster speed.
That's a good one.
Give me 380 Ks, like, right against me.
Hell yes.
I would go train as well, but like a steam train, you know what I mean? Like a real, and like a real, real meaty beef, like big
chunky boy.
Like chunky boy. Chunky I really like just want to, I don't know, get crushed by it, I guess. See what that feels like.
You got to feel it.
I really got to experience that.
Those short, like pure iron bars,
yeah,
great to
I
the
really
front.
Just got to know. And also just like kind of cinematic, I guess.
Yes.
That's true.
You like tied to some tracks. You're like, I can't get out.
I don't know. Maybe I walk out onto the tracks as lean. That's dark.
Because you're like slapping your chest. You're like, hit me.
Hit me, bitch.
Charlie Chaplin style. Like, there's
no idea what that means.
Put some you don't know who Charlie Chaplin is?
No.
Damn.
I famously don't know anything, Yanni.
I don't know why that one surprised me.
Oh, you mean Charlie Chaplin.
All right, shut the fuck up.
Okay, actually, I've changed mine. So what I want to be is maybe like one of the plane wheels that they use when it lands too. But I don't want to be like lying like horizontal. Like I want to be lying like vertically. And so it's like a really good roller. For your back.
Yeah, that'd be really good for the old back.
That would feel so good.
For the old spine.
Yeah, crack those joints from toe to tip.
Exactly.
Holy shit.
Beth's original answer was the Floriade train.
The floor.
Floriade's a flower festival in Canberra. There's a little train that goes through.
Aww, that'd be cute.
so funny.
That's pretty good.
Well, the nose of it looks so good to be hit by.
Yes, honestly, yes. I think I would also, if we're going like outside the realm of regular vehicles, I think being hit by like any like roller coaster or like amusement fair ride, like those ones that are like a pendulum that kind of like swing and stuff, like just get yourself like in position and just let it like belt you into the sky.
You're like on a T-ball tee and you're just waiting, it swings into you and just like shoots you.
Exactly. Like I want it to smack me like a golf club.
I mean, you know, people are entitled to their sexual proclivities, you know. I mean, let there be 1,000 blossoms bloom. But I ain't spending any time.
Hello again, everybody. Hello. Hi, everybody. Hi, Karen.
Oh, hi, Yanni.
Hi, Casey.
Howdy.
Hey, Elle.
Hi, Yanni.
Hi, Beth.
Hi, Yanni.
Hi, Casey.
Hi, Karen.
Hi, Elle.
Hi, Kieran.
Hi, Beth.
Hi, Karen.
Hi, Elle.
Hi, Casey.
Hi, Beth.
Hi, Casey.
She got it right this time.
Yeah, we did it. Hi, Beth.
Hi, Elle.
All right. This is unstrategic, but I like that we're getting good at it. Welcome back to Shouldn't Have Come, where we are talking Ned Kelly, episode 2 of our Ned Kelly miniseries that we're doing. Last week, or half an hour ago for us, we spent some time having some fun looking at cultural depictions of Ned Kelly, the man, before running the mostly accepted Ned Kelly biography by everybody. If you haven't listened to episode 1 of the Ned Kelly series, I highly recommend you give it a go. Now, today we've got a fun one for you. We have roped in Kieran to read out a slightly abridged version of Ned Kelly's famous Geraldry letter, dictated by Ned Kelly to Joe Byrne sometime in February of 1879. Joe then rewrote it with much neater handwriting, and in total it runs 56 pages of roughly A5 paper. The police obviously tried their best to halt the letter's publication, but at some point around his trial and death, it did leak out. So, a couple of notes about this episode we're about to do. I've done some condensing of the letter, because much of it is a scene-by-scene recounting of events that involves a very wide cast of characters. When we were preparing it, it required proper decipherment to figure out, like, wait, who's he talking about? What does this mean? What does that mean? So for the purposes of the episode, I've kind of summarized those incidents. We'll just kind of explain what happens and get back to the political and social heft of the speech. Or, you know, I mean, it's a dictated letter. It's kind of a speech. And on that, Ned's speech. So, accents, they're strange. Both of Ned's parents are Irish. His father is shipped over at 21, and his mother comes over as a child. That's going to be the case for a fair few people around in, like, regional Victoria, who are first-generation Australians. However, the Australian accent that we kind of recognize today has been distinct from the British and Irish accent since at least the 1820s, though it didn't sound like the extremely striny Australian accent that we have today. Heath Ledger and perhaps, obviously, Mick Jagger both played up the Irishness of the accent, whereas the more recent George Mackay Ned Kelly had, I guess, an Australian accent. When I heard his version, my first thought was like Western Sydney. Mm. So I have the trailers from those movies here, which I was going to show everybody.
If Ned Kelly were alive today, he'd probably be Mick Jagger. Mick Jagger as Ned Kelly.
My lips can teach the public that men are made mad by bad dreams.
He lived in Australia in 1880. It was a lot like the American West.
It was a lot like the American West. Only wilder.
The first line in
the
that
wild,
was...
The wild, wild west.
Exactly.
If Ned Kelly were alive today, he'd probably be...
Mick Jagger.
There was just like, there was no subtlety in marketing back then. So that was the Mick Jagger, Ned Kelly. He's doing a schoolboy British accent. Like, he sounds like a really naive British person, I suppose. Yeah.
Which is not what we imagine Ned Kelly to have been like at all.
No, that's not what we're kind of picturing. Here is the Heath Ledger Ned Kelly.
They say the trouble with the Irish is that we rely too much on dreams and not enough on gunpowder.
Get your hands off me!
You're under arrest! Help me, someone!
Is that the best you can do, you bloody coward?
Well, I'm telling you something now, boys. I'm not gonna let the police put one over on me.
Had war declared on us by the crown, the reward on our heads is the biggest one yet offered in the world.
Heath Ledger, Naomi Watts, Orlando Bloom, and Jeffrey Rush.
So, like, dramatized.
Yes, 2003.
Yeah.
Yeah, and melodrama of it all.
Very thick Irish accent, I would say.
Yeah. Very much so.
All of them, Heath, Orlando Bloom, the women in that. Who would I say they were? Naomi Watts.
Oh, yeah, the women.
Yeah, the women's.
The women's.
And finally, the most recent adaptation, George Mackay playing Ned Kelly with, like, an Australian accent.
Mm.
I understand it's, like, an interpretation of what that accent might have sounded like.
Okay.
So that'll play here in just a sec.
A man cannot outrun his destiny. I were but a child, yet I were already traveling full tilt toward the man I would become.
What makes you think I won't kill you right now?
You boys want to build an army? We're going to war.
Fire! You're bloody bulletproof, boys!
Many would call me the coldest-blooded murderer ever, but others, knowing the truth, would call me a hero.
Epic filmmaking. Astonishing.
So yeah, George Mackay, like, it sounded kind of modern Western Sydney accent, a bit like, like...
Yeah, yeah.
He also looks like an Esche.
Yes,
yeah. A little bit Esche. Right. Which, I don't know if it's just because the haircut he has is also, like, the Esche haircut.
Yeah.
So before we finally do get into it, I thought I'd talk about one of the most archetypal, or some of the most archetypal linguistic characteristics of Australian English. What makes it Australian English rather than British English? Mostly this is from Wikipedia, to be clear. So, one of the two of you with an Australian accent, could you please read out the text that'll appear on this next slide eventually? There we go.
I can't dance. My grass plant has advanced examples of bath ants.
That's awful.
Am I doing it right?
That's perfect. Beth, I'm so sorry to hear about the advanced examples of bath ants.
That's beautiful.
That have inhibited your dancing. That's awful news.
That was exactly what I kind of wanted. What we're discussing here is the trap bath split. In Northern England, all of these words are pronounced with the same vowel, the long dentist style ah.
I can't dance. My grass plant has advanced examples of bath ants.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if they just say ants still. Because like, aunts is like aunts, right?
Oh dear, there's aunts in the pantry. Let me out!
Wouldn't it be in the pantry?
In the pantry.
There's my aunt's dancing in the pantry. It's like 500 ants and a lady. Anyway.
That's crazy.
In Southern English, which is where a lot of like Australian English people come from, and like Irish English, Scottish English, as well as like Kiwi, Australian, South African, and Indian English, that splits. So you get dance and plant as opposed to dance and plant. Or dance and plant, I suppose. I can't dance. My grass plant has advanced examples of bath ants, which would be like American way of saying
American.
It.
I can't dance. My grass plant has advanced examples of bath ants.
Yeah, and it really does. It's a real problem. Whereas, some dickhead from Adelaide would say, like, I can't dance. Because this in Adelaide English, in South Australian English, they do not have as pronounced a trap bath split.
Mm.
So it's much more dance, grass, plants, advanced examples of bath aunts. Yeah, it's very
still
fun.
Still did the aunts.
One of the other big, there's a lot of fun names for the linguistic things that Australians experiencing. One of them is the Salary-Celery merger. So this is a regional one where Victoria and Norfolk Island, the way that their accents are developing, they are saying the words salary, and by that I mean the money you earn, and celery, like the vegetable, the same way. Now, I don't think any of you have this accent.
Salary and celery.
Salary, celery.
Yeah, celery, celery.
Yeah, so all of us are saying salary, celery. L?
Yeah, salary, celery.
It's probably closest for you.
I think so, salary, celery.
Yeah, so
it's because I'm like salary, celery.
Yeah.
Salary, celery. I think mine is the closest, but also like I don't have like an Australian accent.
Exactly. No, because this can happen in variants of accents. A lot of different kinds of accents can have something like a salary, celery merger.
Yeah, because I like with that first sentence, like I probably have the closest to like, because I would say I can't dance. My grass plant has advanced examples of bath ants.
Yeah. So you got the third example there. Bath ants.
Yeah, the only one is ants. Everything else is the same.
Because your aunt's okay.
Yeah, my aunt's fine. Well, no, my aunt is not fine.
Your aunt's a problem.
My aunt's a problem.
And we love her for it.
No, we don't.
What about your aunts?
My aunts?
Yeah, you fine with your aunts?
Yeah, I'm fine with them.
That's
more, good. More so than with my aunt.
Anyway, over in the West, in Western Australia, they have more diphthongs than us. So a diphthong is when a vowel is two vowels. An example that we say on our side are the words near, which you would say as
near,
which we say as a single vowel, and square, which you'd say as
square,
single vowel. In Western Australia, they're pronounced near and square.
Oh.
Which is the diphthong.
Okay, so it's that kind of thing you do like when you're a whingy kid and you're like, stop.
Yes. Exactly.
Don't come nearer.
Yeah, don't come near. Exactly. So that's in Western Australian English, that's much more pronounced, the diphthong in those kinds of words, that air kind of accent. Mm. We famously also have the high-rising terminal or upward inflection, the way that we sound like we're asking questions all the time. Apparently it's the same thing as people in California. I've been told this is regarded as an annoying thing about Australian English.
I can't dance. My grass plant has advanced examples of bath ants.
I can't dance. My grass plant has advanced example of bath ants. isn't that fun? And the sound that you'll make when saying the word cure, like the cure to a disease, say it.
Cure.
So that's mostly dead. That used to be present in words like pour, more, and sure, which used to be pronounced like pure.
Oh, the purry thing.
Yeah, exactly. And more, like we're murmuring a boat. More. I can't quite do it. But because now they sound like, now they rhyme with pour, like to pour something, more like more of something, and shore like the shoreline.
Yeah.
But previously there would be a distinction between pour and like, I'm a poor person versus I am pouring something. So that purr, that basically just exists in the word sure in Australian English. And otherwise that vowel has disappeared.
And also not even always in that, like shore.
I mean, in Western Australia, they're saying like, sure.
Sure.
Yeah. So there's that. To be clear, there's apparently three Australian accents. There's broad, general, and cultivated Australian English. Broad is the like striny Steve Irwin, Julia Gillard style.
Exactly. Every single time I do my bootlaces up, I'm staring death right in the eyes. How many baseballers are doing that?
General is how like Karen and Casey sound. And cultivated is like wankers like Kate Blanchett.
And you think, no, I can hear birdsong. I can hear the floorboards creak. I can hear the sound of my own inner monologue, which, frankly, I don't want to listen to most of the time. But, yeah, it's mostly silence.
Have the cultivated Australian English accent. There's also the ABC accent, which is what Kieran does when reading old news headlines for the podcast.
What do you mean?
And there's obviously a continuum of Aboriginal English accents, which range from, like, very, very similar to Australian English to essentially Creoles. So, today, Kieran is going to read the letter in the accent that he's decided, with influences of wherever he wants, but probably just Irish. I think with the combination of accent influences we have going on here, because Kieran has an Australian accent, but we'll be reading it in an Irish accent, I think it'll sound exactly pitch perfect like Ned Kelly.
I'm hoping to attempt it.
No problem.
My Irish accent has always been like my weakest, which is devastating for me. Culturally. Oh,
when I married you, you told me it was your best accent.
Yeah, that's crazy, but I guess you're locked in now, so, you know.
All right, and so no one yells at me. I've added some, like, commas and updated some terminology when he's used a word that we wouldn't recognize. I thought it'd be okay. Is that okay?
Like, I guess. All right. I mean...
I'll allow it.
The original letter really doesn't have any commas or anything, and I just don't want Kieran to asphyxiate himself reading some of these sentences.
I appreciate it, actually. Thank you.
On to the letter. Okay. All right.
Damn, look at that handwriting.
All right, now yes. We're reading straight from Beth.
Got it.
Without further ado, here is the Girildery letter, mostly.
All right. I reckon... I don't know if I can do an Irish accent without it being too, like, you know, like... Oh, dear sir, I wish to acquaint you with some of the occurrences of the present, past, and future.
And do it how, like, do
I
it
don't
how
hear a problem here.
That's fine.
Dear sir, I wish to acquaint you with some of the occurrences of the present, past, and future. In or about the spring of 1870, the ground was so soft.
So Irish.
before you keep going, start again. A bit faster.
Gotcha.
I think the idea is that it's like a kind of rollicking because he's like, there's no commas in the thing because he's just like, I'm going.
Got it.
It's a rant.
All right.
It's a rant, one might
say. It's a rant. Das a. I wish I had quieter. All right.
Terrence and Philip is like,
you'd fuck your uncle.
Das a. I wish to acquaint you with some of the occurrences of the present, past, and future. Yeah. Sorry, everybody. This is like a ball of line, and I'm just like fucking with it. All right. Dear sir, I wish to acquaint you with some of the occurrences of the present, past, and future. In or about the spring of 1870, the ground was very soft, so rotten that it would bog a duck in places. A hawker named Mr. Gould got his wagon bogged between Greta and my mother's house on the 11-mile creek, and he was stopping at my mother's awaiting finer or drier weather. Mr. McCormack and his wife, hawkers also, were camped in Greta, and their horse, Rudicruda, had run away. Mr. Gould was up early finding his horses and seen McCormack's horse, for he knew horses well. He sent his boy to take him back to Greta, and when the McCormacks got the horse, they came straight to Gould and accused him of working the horse. I could not help laughing to hear Mrs. McCormack accusing Gould of using the horse after him being so kind as to send his boy to take Rudicruda back to him. I pleaded Gould's innocent, and Mrs. McCormack turned on me and accused me of bringing the horse from Greta to Gould's wagon to pull him out of the bog. I did not say much to the woman, as my mother was present, but that same day, me and my uncle was cutting calves. I don't know what that means, but that's cool. Gould wrapped up a note and a pair of the calves' testicles and gave them to me to give them to Mrs. McCormack.
You're like cutting up.
That makes sense. Now this all makes, it all comes together. Consequently, McCormack said he would summons me. I told him neither me or Gould used their horse. He said I was a liar, and he could whelp me, or any of my breed. I was about 14 years of age, but accepted the challenge, and dismounting when Mrs. McCormack struck my horse in the flank with a bull shin. It jumped forward and my fist came in collision with McCormack's nose and caused him to lose his equilesbian and fell on his
Hello?
Prostate.
Remember my name?
It jumped forward and my fist came in collision. I'm so sorry.
And you're wearing the hat.
I thought it would give me confidence. I should be wearing it as a beard. I should be wearing it as a beard so I can really get into the vibe of it. Hang on. I'll just make sure I'm not in the way. All right.
Goodness.
Let's see. It jumped forward, and my fist came in collision with McCormack's nose and caused him to lose his equilibrium and fall prostrate. I tied up my horse to finish the battle, but McCormack got up and ran to the police camp. Constable Hall asked me what the row was about. I told him they accused me and Gould of using their horse, and I hit him, and I would do the same to him if he challenged me. McCormack pulled me and swore their lives against me. I was sentenced to 3 months for hitting him and 3 months for the parcel and bound to keep the peace for 12 months. Mrs. McCormack gave good substantial evidence. She is well acquainted with that place called Tasmania, better known as the Durban or Van Diemen's Land. And McCormack, being a policeman over the convicts and women being scarce, released her from that land of bondage and tyranny.
So, first, I love... And then my fist hit him in the face.
That is actually so good. It's just like, well, like, what happened was, right, is I was going up and, like, firstly of all, the Sheila, she hit my horse. And when she hit my horse, I fell off the horse, you see. But in the way that I fell, I punched her man straight in his fucking face, which was, like, full accident. Like,
but
full
I do
accident.
Again.
That's like he fell on my knife.
It
That's
is.
Like
yeah,
that excuse.
He fell on my knife 10 times.
He fell on my knife 10 times. So after this, for a while, Ned tells the story of a man named Wild Wright who's lost a horse. So Ned loans him a horse and is like, if I find your horse, I'll keep that horse.
Okay.
Because you need to go somewhere.
This is a horse trade.
Horse.
And a policeman, Hall, who's the guy with the mustache from the first episode, comes by and tells Ned there's some administrative issue with his bail. And could Ned please come to the barracks with him? We pick back up on page 7 of the jewelry letter.
He said the papers was at the barracks, and I had no idea he wanted to arrest me or I would have quietly rode away instead of going to the barracks. I was getting off when Hall caught hold of me and thought to throw me but made a mistake and came on the broad of his back, himself in the dust. The mare galloped away, and instead of me putting my foot on Hall's neck and taking his revolver and putting him in the lockup, I tried to catch the mare. Hall got up and snapped 3 or 4 caps at me and would have shot me, but the colt's patent refused. This is well known in Greta. When I heard the cap snapping, I stood until Hall came close. He had me covered and was shaking with fear, and I knew he would pull the trigger before he would be game to put his hand on me, so I duped and jumped him, caught the revolver with one hand and Hall by the collar with the other. I dare not strike him, or my sureties would lose the bond money. I made him trip and let him take a mouthful of dust now and again, as he was as helpless as a big goanna after leaving a dead horse or bull. I kept throwing him in the dust until I got him across the street, the very spot where Mrs. O'Brien's hotel stands now. The cellar was just dug then. There was some brush fencing where the post and rail was taking down, and on this I threw a big cowardly haul on his belly. I straddled him and rolled both spurs into his thighs. He roared like a big calf attacked by dogs and shifted several yards of the fence. I got his hands at the back of his neck and tried to make him let the revolver go, but he stuck to it like grim death on a dead volunteer. He called for assistance to a man named Cohen and Barnett Lewis, Thomas Jewell, 2 blacksmiths who was looking on. I dare not strike any of them as I was bound to keep the peace, or I could have spread those curs like dung in a paddock. They got ropes, tied my hands and feet, and Hall beat me over the head with his 6-chambered Colt's revolver. 9 stitches were put in some of the cuts by Dr. Hastings, and when Wild Wright and my mother came, they could trace us across the street by the blood in the dust, which spoiled the luster of the paint on the gateposts outside the barracks.
So Ned's imprisoned for stealing this horse. He spends 3 years in the Beechworth prison. The doctor who treated Ned's injuries dies before the trial, so he's not able to give the potentially exonerative evidence on Ned's behalf that he was, you know, beaten up. And Ned also accuses the police of being the primary horse thieves in the area. And he says they're basically taking the horses to another town to sell them where people can't buy them back because it's too far away. At one point, Ned says, therefore, the Minister of Justice neglected his duty in that case, but there was never such a thing as justice in the English laws. He also says the cops are the greatest horse stealers with the exception of myself, which is gold. And then he says at one point they stole 60 horses in one day. And he starts stealing horses from the cops and selling them to, like, other people. And some of those people end up getting convicted for having stolen horses. But Ned's like, no, I stole the horses. They were just buying horses.
It's like, yeah, they bought the horses. I stole them. And that's my thing.
And we pick back up on page 18.
William Cook, who was convicted for stealing Whitty's horses, was innocent. He was not in my company at Peterson's. But it is not the place of the police to convict guilty men, as it is by them to get their living. Had the right parties been convicted, it would have been a bad job for the police, as Berry would have sacked a great many of them. Only I came to their aid and kept them in their billets and good employment and got them double pay. And yet, the ungrateful articles convicted my mother and an infant, my brother-in-law and another man who was innocent, and still annoy my brothers and sisters, and the ignorant unicorns even threatened to shoot myself. But as soon as I am dead, there will be no more police required. They will be sacked and supplanted by soldiers on low pay in the towns and special constables made of some of the farmers to make up for this double pay and expense. It will pay government to give those people who are suffering innocence, justice and liberty. If not, I will be compelled to show some colonial stratagem which will open the eyes of not only the Victorian police and inhabitants, but also the whole British army. And no doubt they will acknowledge their hounds were barking at the wrong stump, and that Fitzpatrick will be the cause of greater slaughter to the Union Jack than St. Patrick was to the snakes and toads of Ireland.
So Fitzpatrick is like a corrupt cop, and him and his boys are harassing the rest of the Kelly family because Ned is on the run. He's like, I became a rambling gambler, which is, just, what do I say?
That's fun.
The police try to arrest Dean, but Ned's mum says they need a warrant to do that. So the cops are like, we'll shoot you. And she says, it's lucky for you that Ned's not here because he'd put his revolver down your throat. So then Ned's little brother is like, Dan, he's like, look, Ned's over there. And the cops all turn and he takes the guy's gun and drives him off.
Bro, come on now.
Is the claim being made?
I just love how the look over there has been like ephemeral. It's just like ageless. Forever.
Look over there. It's 1876 and Ned Kelly's behind you.
This is like some kids show shit where it's just like, have you seen Ned? Behind you.
It's Dora the Explorer. Yeah, exactly. They're swatting people with
Can
Ned
Can you
Kelly.
See where Ned has gone? Yeah. The bush.
Yeah. Anyway, so they get the cops away. We're back on page 22. Ned's explaining that all that happened.
All right. Next day, Williamson and my mother were arrested, and Skilly and fuck me. This is a horny letter made by a horny man locked in an eternal suffering of bushland and longing for bush, man.
Come on.
You all right, anyway. Keep that in. You
anyway,
can't,
anyway,
you can't,
anyway,
you can't
anyway.
I will.
It doesn't matter. All right. Next day, Williamson and my mother were arrested, and Skillian the day after, who was not there at all at the time of the row, which can be proved by 8 or 9 witnesses. And the police got credit and praise in the papers for arresting the mother of 12 children, one an infant on her breast, and those 2 quiet, hard-working, innocent men who would not know the difference in a revolver and a saucepan handle, and kept them 6 months awaiting trial, and then convicted them on the evidence of the meanest article that ever the sun shone on. It seems that the jury were well chosen by the police, as there was a discharged sergeant amongst them, which is contrary to law. They thought it impossible for a policeman to swear a lie, but I can assure them, it is by that means and hiring cads they get promotion. I have heard from a trooper that he never knew Fitzpatrick to be one night sober, and that he sold his sister to a Chinaman.
Whoa.
The deceit and cowardice is too plain to be seen in the puny, cabbage-hearted-looking face. I heard I was outlawed, with a £100 bounty for shooting at a trooper in Victoria, and a £100 reward for any man that could prove a conviction of horse-stealing against me. So I came back to Victoria, knowing I would get no justice if I gave myself up. I inquired after my brother Dan and found him digging on Bullet Creek. Heard how the police used to be blown that they would not ask me to stand. They would shoot me first and then cry surrender. And how they used to rush into the house, upset all the milk dishes, break tins of eggs, empty the flour out of the bags and onto the ground, and even the meat out of the cask and destroy all the provisions, and shove the girls in front of them into the rooms like dogs. So if anyone was there, they would shoot the girls first. But they knew well I was not there, or I would have scattered their blood and brains like rain. I would manure the 11 mile with their bloated carcasses, and yet remember, there is not one drop of murderous blood in my veins. Those men certainly made my blood boil, as I don't think there is a man born who could have the patience to suffer it as long as I did, or ever allow his blood to get cold while such insults as these were unavenged. And yet, in every paper that is printed, I am called the blackest and coldest-blooded murderer ever on record. But if I hear any more of it, I will not exactly show them what cold-blooded murder is, but wholesale and retail slaughter, something different to shooting three troopers in self-defense and robbing a bank. They were not satisfied with frightening my sisters night and day and destroying their provisions and lagging my mother and an infant and those innocent men, but should follow me and my brother into the wilds where he had been quietly digging, neither molesting or interfering with anyone. He was making good wages, as the creek is very rich within half a mile from where I shot Kennedy. I was not there long, and on the 25th October, I came on police tracks between Tabletop and the bogs.
So, Ned and Dan discover the police hideout, and they decide to try to take the cops' guns and ammo. In the ensuing skirmish, one of the cops, Lonergan, takes aim at Ned, and Ned shoots him in the eye. Ned and Dan shoot and kill two of the other cops, and one of the cops who surrendered, McIntyre, has a chat with Ned, with McIntyre claiming the rest of the police knew that the Kelly gang had been wronged.
He said they did not come to shoot me. They came to apprehend me. I asked him what they carried Spencer rifles, breech loading, fouling places, and so much ammunition for. The police was only supposed to carry one revolver and six cartridges in the revolver, but they had 18 rounds of revolver cartridges, each three dozen for the fouling piece and 21 Spencer rifle cartridges, and God knows how many they had away with the rifle. This looked as if they meant not only to shoot me, only to riddle me. He said he would get them to give up their arms if I would not shoot them, as I could not blame them. They had to do their duty. I said I did not blame them for doing honest duty, but I could not suffer them blowing me to pieces in my own native land, and they knew Fitzpatrick wronged us, and why not make it public and convict him? But no, they would rather riddle poor, unfortunate Creoles. But they will rue the day ever Fitzpatrick got among them. This cannot be called willful murder, for I was compelled to shoot them or lie down and let them shoot me. It would not be willful murder if they packed our remains and shattered into a massive animated gore to Mansfield. They would have gotten great praise and credit as well as promotion, but I am recorded a horrid brute because I had not been cowardly enough to lie down for them under such trying circumstances and insults to my people. Certainly their wives and children are to be pitied, but they must remember those men came into the bush with the intention of scattering pieces of me and my brother all over the bush, and yet they know and acknowledge I have been wronged. And my mother has no alternative, only to put up with the brutal and cowardly conduct of a parcel of big, ugly, fat-necked, wombat-headed, big-bellied, magpie-legged, narrow-hipped, splore-footed sons of Irish bailiffs or English landlords, better known as officers of justice or Victoria Police, who some calls honest gentlemen. But I would like to know what business an honest man would have in the police, as it is an old saying, it takes a rogue to catch a rogue. And a man that knows nothing about roguery would never enter the force and take an oath to arrest brother, sister, father, or mother if required. A policeman is a disgrace to his country and ancestors and religion, as they were all Catholics before the Saxons and Cranmore yoke held sway. Since then, they were persecuted, massacred, thrown into martyrdom, and tortured beyond the ideas of the present generation.
Yup.
What would people say if they saw a strapping big lump of an Irish? Sorry. Forgive.
Is this my Tinder profile?
What would they say?
Hey.
Okay. What would people say if they saw a strapping big lump of an Irishman shepherding sheep for 15 bob a week, or tailing turkeys in Tallaroc Ranges for a smile, or even begging for his tucker? Where are these strapping big lumps of Irishmen just asking for a friend?
Where have all the strapping big lumps of Irishmen
gone?
And where are all the gods?
They would say he ought to be ashamed of himself and tar and feather him. But he would be a king to a policeman, who for a lazy, loafing, cowardly billet left the Ash Corner, deserted the Shamrock, the emblem of true wit and beauty, to serve under a flag in a nation that has destroyed, massacred and murdered their forefathers by the greatest of torturers, rolling them downhill in spiked barrels, pulling their toes and fingernails, and on the wheel and every torture imaginable. Moore was transported to Van Diemen's Land to pine their young lives away in starvation and misery amongst tyrants worse than the promised hell itself. All of true blood, bone and beauty that was not murdered on their own soil or had fled to America or other countries to bloom again another day were doomed to Port Macquarie, Toongabby and Norfolk Island and Emu Plain. And in those places of tyranny and condemnation, many a blooming Irishman, rather than subdued to the Saxon yoke, were flogged to death and bravely died in servile chains, but true to the Shamrock and a credit to Paddy's Land. What would people say if I became a policeman and took an oath to arrest my brothers, sisters and relations and convict them by fair or foul means after the conviction of my mother and the persecutions and insults offered to myself? The Queen must surely be proud of such heroic men as the police and Irish soldiers.
Soldiers. Soldier boy, tell them. Got a new dance for y'all called a soldier boy. You.
Sorry to the... Sorry, just a moment.
Soldier boy, tell him.
Just thinking of an old man doing it. Anyway. Right. The Queen must surely be proud of such heroic men as the police, as it takes 8 or 11 of the biggest mud crushers in Melbourne to take one poor little half-starved larrikin to a watch house. I've seen as many as 11 big and ugly enough to lift Mount Macedon out of a crab hole, more like the species of a baboon or gorilla than a man, actually come into a courthouse and swear they could not arrest one 50-kilogram larrikin. And the magistrate could send the poor little larrikin into a dungeon for being a better man than such a parcel of armed curs. What would England do if America declared war and hoisted a green flag? It is all Irishmen that has got command of England's armies, forts and artillery. Even her very lifeguards and beef tasters are Irish. Would they not slew round and fight her with their own arms for the sake of the colour they dare not wear for years, and to reinstate it and rise old Erin's Isle once more from the pressure and tyrannism of the English yoke, which has kept them in poverty and starvation and caused them to wear the enemy's coat? What else can England expect? Is there not big fat-necked unicorns enough paid to torment and drive me to do things which I don't wish to do without the public assisting them? I have never interfered with any person unless they deserved it, and yet there are civilians who take firearms against me for what reason I do not know. Unless they want me to turn on them and exterminate them. If I had robbed and plundered, ravished and murdered everything I met, young and old, rich and poor, the public could not do any more than take firearms and assist the police as they have done. But by the light that shines, pegged on an ant bed with their bellies opened, their fat taken out, rendered and poured down their throat boiling hot, they will be fooled to what pleasure I will give some of them. And any person aiding or harbouring or assisting the police in any way whatever, or employing any person whom they know to be a detective, or cad, or those who would be so depraved as to take blood money, will be outlawed and declared unfit to be allowed human burial. Get crazy for that one. Their property will either be consumed or confiscated, and them and theirs and all belonging to them exterminated off the face of the earth. I shall give a payable reward, for I would like to know who made that article. He reminds me of a poodle dog half-clipped in the lion fashion, called Brooker Smith Super Nintendo. Oops. Called Brooker Smith, Superintendent of Police. I almost did it again. It was so close.
Yeah, I was like, what could you have said that is close to Super Nintendo?
Super Nintendo. And he mains Waluigi. Pussy behaviour.
Doesn't declare burial.
Yeah, it doesn't fucking deserve it. He loves a blue shell, the cunt. All right.
Bury him in bananas.
Fucking banana, bitch. He knows as much about commanding police as Captain Standing does about mustering mosquitoes and boiling them down for their fat on the back blocks of the Lachlan. For he has a head like a turnip, a stiff neck as big as his shoulders, narrow-hipped and pointed towards the feet like a vine snake.
He's roast of fire.
he's a lyrical genius, you honestly. Know? He really is a poet.
If there is any one to be called a murderer regarding Kennedy, Scanlan and Lonergan, it is that misplaced poodle. He gets as much pay as a dozen good troopers, if there is any good in them. And what does he do for it? He cannot look behind him without turning his whole frame. It takes 3 or 4 police to keep sentry while he sleeps in Warrangatta for fear of body snatchers. Do they think he is a superior animal to the men they have to guard him? If so, why not send the men that gets big pay reckoned superior to the common police after me? You shall soon save the country of high salaries to men that is fit for nothing else but getting better men than himself shot and sending orphan children to the industrial school to make prostitutes for the detectives and other evil disposed persons.
Whoa.
Send the high paid men that receive big salaries for years in a gang by themselves after me, as it will make no difference to them, but it will give the public a chance of showing whether they are worth more than a common trooper or not. And I think the public will soon find out that they are only in the road of good men. I do not call McIntyre a coward, as he is as good a man as wears the jacket. He had the presence of mind to know his position directly he was spoken to. It is only foolishness to disobey an outlaw. It was cowardice and foolhardiness made Lonergan fight. It was his foolhardiness to disobey an outlaw, as it means a speedy dispatch to kingdom come. I would advise all those who join the stock protection to withdraw their money and give it to the poor of Greta, where I have spent and will again spend many happy days, fearless, free and bold. I would advise them to subscribe a sum and give it to the poor of their district, as no man could steal their horse or cattle without the knowledge of the poor, and they would rise as one man and find it if it was on the face of the earth. The police can't protect you. All those that have reason to fear me had better sell out and give £10 out of every 100 to the Widow and Orphan Fund. And do not attempt to reside in Victoria but as short a time as possible after reading this notice. Neglect this and abide by the consequence which shall be worse than rust in wheat in Victoria or the drought of a dry season to the grasshoppers in New South Wales. I do not wish to give the order full force without giving timely warning, but I am a widow's son, outlawed, and my orders must be obeyed.
Ooh.
That is the...
Hoo-wee!
That's the Geraldry letter. Thank you very much, Karen.
It's a banger. He's got some fucking, like, reads in there. That's crazy.
Yeah, there's some highlights. I definitely really loved the, God, what did he call them? The Sons of Irish Bailiffs.
Yeah, that one was fire. Hang on, where was that?
Parcel of big, ugly, fat-necked, wombat-headed, big-bellied, magpie-legged, narrow-hipped, splore-footed Sons of Irish Bailiffs and English Landlords.
That one slaps.
Right near the end, that very confusing sentence, which is like, I would advise them to subscribe a sum and give it to the poor of their district, as no man could steal their horse or cattle without the knowledge of the poor, and they would rise as one man and find it if it was on the face of the earth. So that's probably one of the more communist lines, I suppose, because he's basically saying that the poor know what is happening. If you are stealing somebody's cattle, the poor people in that region tend to know because they're everywhere. And the police should start, like, treating the poor better. You know, subscribe a sum and give it to the poor of their district. Because, yeah, the poor people of a district are the people that run that area. Mm-hmm. Is yeah. what he's saying with that, I think.
And also seems to be, like, you know, a kind of, like, potentially even, like, you know, an intervention into criminality as well. Being like, hey, you know... people wouldn't be doing crimes if they, you know, were able to survive without doing crimes.
Yep, yep, people.
Mm-hmm. I wouldn't be stealing horses if I didn't have to steal horses or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, right near the end, he says, like, you know, I want to be, like, happy and free in Greta. Like, he's like, I'm not, like, trying to do this because it's the best option. You'll keep coming to my house. You'll harass my mom. You arrest my mom. You harass my sisters. You arrest my brothers.
Yeah.
You're stealing all these horses. Yeah, and so that letter is in, I think, in the last few months of his life, even the last couple of months of his life is when that's written. It's, yeah, dictated to Joe Byrne in the couple of days before they go into a raid. It's, I've never actually read it before. I hadn't even heard that iconic first line, you know, dear sir, I wish to acquaint you with matters of the present, past, and future. And that last line of, I am a widow's son, outlawed and my orders must be obeyed. Like, those feel like crazy. I feel like this might have been an interesting document to read in school, I suppose.
Absolutely.
For, you know, a lot of different elements, and obviously its publication was stopped by Victoria Police at many occasions. Because there's obviously a lot of, like, violent language towards police. Like, where he talks about...
Absolutely.
I mean, some of the very more lurid language about, like, what he's going to... He's going to paint the manure, the soil with their corpses and such.
Yeah.
But also some, I would say, systemic critiques of how the police work, like with specific examples of how police officers have mistreated himself and his family. But during the letter, he talks about, for instance, how many police there are that are apparently required for things, how many guns that they like have and how many bullets they have. Yeah, so that was the Giraldry letter. Thank you very much, Kieran, for reading that. And that will round us into, I guess, our little conclusion. Does anyone have any, I guess, parting thoughts about Ned Kelly before we round out here?
Baller.
Yeah, for sure. That was really sick. I think it's given the, you know, the one-star review of like, oh, you know, Ked Kelly can't read or whatever in school. That was really, really well articulated. And also, you're right, he makes a lot of very, like, salient points about the situation he's in, about the system that's operating, how it's kind of rigged against him on a lot of different sides, as well as like the people in general. I didn't expect it. I guess the way that Ned Kelly is framed, I suppose, and his relationship with the police in pop culture, or at least in my understanding, has been very much like, oh yeah, fuck the cops, your dog kind of thing, which yes, absolutely. But it was very, very cool to actually read what he was thinking, and also like to be like, hey, here are all my very like well thought out points about why fuck the pigs. Also fuck the pigs. Which I thought was like really, really cool. I feel like we don't really get a lot of insight into that side of Australia, particularly when we learn about the history of it.
Yeah,
as like Kieran was saying, I really enjoyed how they were able to add like more of a three dimension to him as well. So rather than like, oh, fuck this, fuck that, it was actually well explained points, which I appreciated.
Yeah, it's in a lot of depth. It's quite a long letter. Definitely recommend. There's a transcription available, obviously, as well as scans of not the original letter. I think this is like a neater copy that Joe Byrne does at a later date or something that hands someone else. I hope you enjoyed that. I hope you enjoyed the episode, everybody. If you'd like more of this, you can follow us on Patreon, patreon.com/shouldn'tcome. You can email us at shouldn'tcome@gmail.com. You can follow us on YouTube, where you'll see slideshows, youtube.com/@shouldn'tcome. And finally, my album's on Bandcamp. That's yanniax.bandcamp.com. Thanks for joining us in this chat about Ned Kelly. We will see you again in the near future. And, well, I suppose it has come to this.
Such is life.
My legs hurt.
Fuck. Stop it.